Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell yesterday sketched a Republican strategy for the next 2 years that focuses on obstructionism and ends in 2012 with the election of a Republican president. While campaigning, Republican candidates railed against the stimulus bill and promised to repeal Obama's health care reform legislation. McConnell said his party probably cannot achieve the legislative shakeup that it wants in the next 2 years because, he says, President Obama will use his veto powers to stop their agenda. McConnell promised that until the White House is again occupied by a Republican, the GOP would increase investigations into federal agencies, vote to deny funds for implementing health care legislation, and freeze discretionary spending. Meanwhile, White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs yesterday repeated that President Obama is willing to compromise with Republicans and discuss a 1 or 2 year extension of the Bush tax cuts for families with annual incomes of more than $250,000. After months of refusing to budge on this point, President Obama announced his new, softer position during Wednesday's post-election press conference. Between the Republican pledges to continue holding the national legislature hostage and the president caving to the right-wing talking points, progressives are bracing for another 2 years of frustrations and dead ends. But in an article for the Huffington Post, Karen Dolan writes that progressives have actually a good reason to see Tuesday as a victory. Karen Dolan is a fellow at the Institute of Policy Studies and co-author of the IPS report Battered by the Storm, How the Safety Net is Failing Americans and How to Fix It. Welcome to Uprising, Karen Dolan.
Thanks for having me.
Well, your article in the Huffington Post really, I think, provides that silver lining that a lot of people are hoping for but not really seeing very much. Why do you see the elections on Tuesday as somewhat of a win for progressives?
Well, I want to be clear. I don't see it as a victory. It clearly wasn't a victory for a progressive agenda, but I do think that there is some optimism and some hope in the fact that most all of the Congressional Progressive Caucus members maintained their seats. I think that we as progressives need to find something hopeful, and I think it's significant that in this time of Citizens United that about 80 progressives were able to govern with integrity and maintain their seats. Now, that's not everything, but it's not nothing.
So the Congressional Progressive Caucus has over 80 members, and most of them, except for, I believe for three, were reelected.
That's right. And Carolyn Kilpatrick lost in the primaries. So they do have a net loss of four, but that was pretty good. And by contrast, the Blue Dogs, who were the more conservative Democrats and in many cases obstacles to a progressive agenda, their ranks were cut in half. So we still have the Congressional Progressive Caucus is the largest caucus within the Democratic caucus. They're still very good and important allies on the Hill. I think we should take heart in the fact that most of them were able to maintain their seats. It's a tragic loss for us of Feingold and Alan Grayson. The other two that lost were Phil Hare and Hall. But we have some really great champions left in the House of Representatives. And this is somewhat of a foundation that I think we should appreciate that we have, that we should utilize it to the best that we can over the next 2 years, that we should build upon it, and that we should recognize that this is indeed a silver lining for us, if a small one.
And so just to emphasize again, the Blue Dog Democratic aspect of the party, the Blue Dog Democratic Caucus itself, was halved almost from 54 members. And many listeners may recall the Blue Dog Democrats were some of the worst enemies of the Democratic Party and a progressive agenda in the last 2 years. Their numbers were halved from 54 to 26 in this past election, which also says something about where most Americans or many Americans are. It's not as though the whole country is gone right wing, if you will. You also say in your piece that the veil of a happy Democratic governing majority is finally lifted. We didn't have it then. We don't have it now. So you explain that a little bit more in terms of what you mean by the veil of a happy Democratic governing majority.
Well, it's true we were able to get a lot of good bills out of the House, but in other cases there was a lot of resistance and a lot of pressure to water things down with regard to the health care bill. There was a lot of resistance and obstacles from Blue Dogs for extending unemployment insurance, for instance. These things were great impediments, I believe, to us. And then, of course, we didn't have a functioning governing majority in the Senate. So we weren't able to get a lot of things done that needed to be done, and at the same time were seen as or were easily painted by Republicans as the party in power, and that if we couldn't get these things done, this is the fault of the Democrats and Obama being lacking leadership and being unable to get our agenda passed.
So you're saying that it was less a matter of Republican obstructionism and more a matter of the Democratic Party's own ranks working against itself?
It was a function of both. But yes, the Democratic Party was not unified in a way that progressives would have liked to have seen to get real health care reform passed.
They were certainly not as unified as Republicans are.
That's right. And, you know, that hasn't changed, but there is a way in which the ranks are more clarified now, where we still have this solid progressive bloc. In some senses, there's an unencumbrance. It doesn't mean that we'll be able to get our agenda passed. We won't. But there's a possibility for being able to, if we're smart about it, put the blame where it belongs now in the obstructionist maneuvers of the Republican Party, on a Republican Party having no ideas. So as they're trying to struggle and now herd their own cats to do something to fix the economy, if they try to fix the economy, to see what are their ideas and to balance them against the ideas that the Democrats have. This isn't, you know, we don't want to be too rosy about it. This is a hard road to hoe. There's no question about that. But I think the progressives should take part to have some kind of appreciation of what we do have left, not just to throw up our hands in despair and say, well, that's it, it's all over, you know, sit on our hands. That would be the worst thing we can do. We can't afford despair.
Mm-hmm.
So what we need to do is look for hope in any avenue we have, and having a good, solid bloc progressives in the House is not a small thing.
Now, one of the things that you do say in your article that we link to from our website is that we also have a president who is presumably less encumbered by the false illusion that playing nice will get him a date with the other team. However, it seems as though the day after the election, the president was bending over backwards to please Republicans instead of holding the line on letting the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy expire. He's now saying in a capitulation that he is willing to let them be extended for wealthy families by 1 or 2 years. I don't think the president's got the message.
No, but that's up to us, isn't it? I think also the last 2 years, progressives were by and large complacent, if not complicit, in much of the unproductive bipartisanship that the president was attempting. And I think that we now have learned our lesson, if the president hasn't. And it's really up to us. We can't extend a honeymoon period. We can't be as forgiving of Barack Obama. We have to be responsible ourselves and our grassroots movements to speak as loudly as we can and be willing to hold his feet to the fire in a way that I think we hadn't done in the last 2 years. Mm. I think there's nothing like losing that can put fire under the feet of progressives. I mean, we could go the other way in despair And that would be to the detriment of the country if we did.
I'm speaking with Karen Dolan. She's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. She's also the co-author of the IPS report, Battered by the Storm, How the Safety Net is Failing Americans and How to Fix It. Now, let's talk about what you think needs to happen and what may end up happening with the Bush tax cuts. These are tax cuts for both the middle class and families making above $250,000. And the Democratic Party and the president had been holding fast to the line that the tax cuts for the wealthy would not be allowed to be extended, partly because it also worsens our deficit, but also that the tax cuts for the middle class would be extended. And now they are backtracking off of it. What do you think Republicans and Democrats are actually going to conclude on the tax cuts? Are they going to basically push through tax cuts for everybody in the end?
Well, the Republicans, of course, want it both ways. They want to push through tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans, and they claim that they're coming to Washington to cut deficit spending. So there may be somewhat of a fight within the Democratic Party. On the other hand, it's up to us to expose that contradiction and that hypocrisy and not to sit back and say, okay, Obama needs to compromise now. We did that. I believe that we did that during the health care bill, not all of us, but I think that a lot of Democrats and progressives said, well, we've got to make this compromise. We can't hold fast on single payer. We can't do that anymore. The hard numbers are on our side. The economists have demonstrated that tax cuts for the wealthy do not, in fact, stimulate the economy. Trickle-down economics has been discredited a long time ago. This is quite obvious that an extension of tax cuts at this level will not do what the Republicans claim they want to do, which is deficit reduction.
Right. And on that issue, the president, in response to Republicans' concerns about the deficit, appointed a deficit commission whose findings are to be revealed on December 1st. And the Democrats have pledged to take up the findings off the panel, whichever way it turns out. I don't know how that's going to work out. But what do you expect the Deficit Commission to come up with? There aren't, you know, terribly progressive people on this Deficit Commission.
No, and we have to fight whatever regressive suggestions come out of this.
I mean, could we see a tax on Social Security and Medicare, as many people fear?
Of course. I mean, what's likely to come out of this commission is not necessarily what's best for the country. And again, it's incumbent upon us. Even when we had the a so-called governing majority on the Hill, or even when we had those 60 seats that the Republicans took in the House, the findings of something like the deficit commission wouldn't have met with the same level of opposition from Democratic members of Congress as they do from us. We are the ones who need to push on this. We're the ones who need to create the groundswell and the opposition and the protest and the grassroots movement that objects to this. We have, you know, we've got the numbers on our side. We've got the economists on our side. We've got the fact of what stimulates an economy and what doesn't. And let's look at the military budget. Are they going to come up with cuts to the military budget? I mean, so far, we've allowed both Democrats and Republicans to exempt the military budget from any deficit talk. And within our own ranks of progressives, for many years, we have had a split between domestic budget priorities and, let's say, you know, peace activists and anti-war activists who want to cut the military budget. I think that's starting to change, and I think that will change by necessity when we're trying to fight this idea of what's the best way in the long term to cut the deficit. There's no question in the short term that we must do deficit spending, and there's no dearth of evidence to that effect. But we've got to come together as progressives and bring the human needs people together with the anti-war people and cut military spending. Fund the wars. That's where the vast majority of our deficit spending comes from. We've got, and we've got our Congressional Progressive Caucus. Many of those members have that line and have that argument. Not all.
Well, finally, Karen, let me ask you this in the last few minutes of our interview. What form should public pressure on the president and Democrats take, you think, at this point? You know, progressives know how to oppose a Republican president and a Republican agenda, Republican-controlled Congress, but I don't think we really know how best to pressure a Democratic president, particularly one who is already being attacked, you know, in another way by conservatives, and so you know, and many of those attacks come in racist forms as well.
Well, I think one thing we have to do is emphasize not those who came out and voted in the midterm election, which was, you know, 40% where there were Tea Partiers and less in other places, but those who stayed home. And the ones who stayed home, Barack Obama needs to pay attention to and why they stayed home. So young people stayed home. You know, people who had voted for him in 2008 were not inspired enough by his leadership to come out and vote for him. And if he wants them and us to come out and vote for him in 2012, then he will do well to listen to us on immediate public job creation. Put people back to work. Good jobs now. That means public jobs.
Well, you said earlier that it's not up to, you know, it's really up to progressives to push Obama and not up to Obama to woo us. So again, my question is, how should progressives push Obama?
Well, we should push him on jobs. I mean, we should push him.
I mean, are you talking about street demonstrations, or are you talking about organizations doing the kind of lobbying and campaigning that they did in the Bush years, or all of the above?
All of the above. We need to have ad hoc hearings on the Hill. We need to get unemployed workers there having their voices heard. We need to do media campaigns. We need to do lobbying visits. We need to outline what can be done in executive orders and get people pushing that. We need to work inside the administration where we have openings. We need to work on the street where we don't have openings. We need to find people who can find the bridge between the inside and the outside. We need to be working all of these things. And I think that we have done it before. I think that we came together and did a lot of this sort of innovative, creative organizing after the second election of Bush. And we built the groundwork so that 2008 was a groundswell, and we need to do the same thing now. I think we let down our guard the last 2 years, and this is the prime opportunity for us to not do that this time.
Karen Dolan, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Karen Dolan is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and the co-author of the IPS report Battered by the Storm, How the Safety Net is Failing Americans and How to Fix It. She's also written an article in the Huffington Post called Buck Up, People, Progressives Won. We will link to that from our website, uprisingradio.org, later today.